dancing in the apocalypse.
I gotta get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and sparkle, Neely, sparkle.
I know what some of your big city no bra wearing hairy legged women livers might say.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 256, and I'm here with my bag of tricks. Oh, yeah, that's me. It's your host, Ify Whiteyway, and of course, I'm in the booth with my friends. So let me introduce you to them. First up, we have the Christmas Zaddy himself, looking good. Hair is popping, and you know, it's real snackish. I wish y'all were in here with me. Alonzo Duralde, what's good?
Oh, I'll tell you what's good, Ify. This is not breaking news. This has been around for a while, but because this is a show that I think is really great and has not yet had any kind of announcement yet regarding a second season, I want to give it a little love just so maybe the TV deities will give us more. And that would be Showtime's I Love That For You, which stars the great Vanessa Bayer as a young woman who winds up getting a job as a host on a home shopping channel. And when she's about to get fired, she sort of blurts out, "I have cancer," which as a child she did, but as an adult she does not. But nonetheless, it's just this lie that snowballs and snowballs and snowballs and just gets more and more tension creating as it goes along. But as we get to know the other people at the home shopping channel, obviously there's a lot of other mini dramas going on. So everything is kind of building up to a head. Really terrific supporting cast, Molly Shannon, Matt Rogers, if you were not already getting enough of him from Fire Island, he is terrific in this. But of course, all kudos to my queen, Jennifer Lewis, who just got her walk on the Hollywood Star of Fame, well-deserved. She is amazing, amazing, amazing on this show. And it's just very twisty and funny and odd and observant. It's really great, and I'm not hearing people talk about it enough because it's not like there aren't a gajillion other television programs jockeying for our media attention right now. But yeah, if you haven't watched it yet, I Love That For You.
Yay! I love Jennifer Lewis. You said she got her walk on the Star of Fame?
And she did. Yes. She walked right over those
she
stars.
She walked right over it.
All right. Well, you know, pedantic as ever, it is none other than the queen of the Midwest, super producer, festival programmer, Drea Clark. What's good?
I wasn't trying to shame him. I didn't know if he wanted to do that.
Sounded very shaming to me.
Yeah, oh, that's your story now. Yeah.
And now that she's called out.
Drea Clark, professional asshole, reporting for duty. What's good with me is also television related, and it's actually from a few weeks ago. As you guys know, I'm a huge fan of RuPaul's Drag Race in all of its iterations. All-Star 7, looking the winner of winners, the queen of all queens, is so good. This whole season's been spectacular. But I meant to mention this a couple weeks ago when episode 8 came out, because Janixa Bravo, who directed Zola, which we spoke about here and all really love, was the guest. And she was on the episode and did the sort of like directing them in their complete nonsense Christmas-themed drag sketch thing that they do. And it's always like double entendre, just above. This woman gives the most, it's like a 5-minute masterclass in how to direct. Like, she is giving them earnest, thoughtful direction on line delivery, on performance motivation. And she's talking to this lineup of drag queens, half of which are wearing Christmas themed costumes. It was phenomenal. I was so excited. I absolutely, yeah, I got super psyched, and I definitely emailed Janixa Bravo, who said she died as soon as it finished. So please, RIP Janixa Bravo, and honor her memory by watching this episode. So good. She's so good.
Well, you know who else is so good? It's the co-host of Max Fun's own Just the Zoo of Us, an animal review podcast, Ellen Weatherford. What's good?
Hey, y'all.
Yeah. Yay, Ellen.
Hi. It's so nice to talk to y'all. I do have a pick that is also a TV show.
Yeah.
Bring it home.
It is. Are you ready to put your nerd hats on?
So ready.
Never took mine off.
It's Prehistoric Planet. Have you seen it?
Tell me everything.
It is a BBC documentary on Apple TV. And it's David Attenborough straight up. If you've ever seen like Planet Earth, like all of those David Attenborough BBC nature documentaries, this time it's dinosaurs.
So David Attenborough is doing Richard Attenborough, right?
Right. Gorgeous. It is so beautiful. And the dinosaurs are rendered so beautifully and accurately. They have feathers, feathers now. We're doing feathers.
We're doing feathers. Now
this season,
this is
I went to Milan and all I saw was feathers on dinosaurs.
Wednesdays we wear pink and every other day is feathers.
It's gorgeous, but they also like something that I really like is that they really bring them to life by using like behavioral animal biology from real world animals in really, really fascinating ways. Things that I was watching and I was like, oh, muskox do that, or oh, emus do that. So like I'm watching this and I'm like, I can clearly see exactly where they were taking like real world inspiration from. But also, of course, they had like a robust team of paleontologists doing like science consultation on this. So it's like wild. They did take some creative liberties. Like they gave some dinosaurs like weird inflatable throat pouches, which were like purely for the vibes, basically. Like, I don't know, we thought it would be cool, we put inflatable throat pouches on them, and you're like, yeah, you're right, it was cool actually,
because they're flattering on everyone in inflatable so throat pouches.
Also big in Milan this year.
So silly, but I really enjoyed it. It's only 5 episodes, each episode is like an hour long, but you can totally like binge it in a weekend, especially if you have kids.
Nice. Good solid. Iffy, what's good with you?
Ooh, what's good with me is, you know, another week, another con. Just got back from DreamCon in Arlington, Texas. It was hot as hell. Mm-hmm. Jesus Christ. I love being in Arlington because it just reminds me of King of the Hill, which I did recently start rewatching. And it's so funny because it's always funny when you like rewatch a very well regarded show and go, this show is so good. And you're like, yeah, that's why I got so many seasons. But I am one to go, that show really is good. And you rewatch it, and like, even rewatching it now, it kind of was ahead of its time because there were things that you think that they would, you know, err on the side of, you know, I'll just say dumb, and they went for the smarter joke all the time, which was great.
If I ever left the entertainment industry, it would be to go sell propane and propane accessories.
Yeah, exactly.
With Chuck Mangione.
With Chuck Mangione, yes.
Yeah, the town is Arlen, which is partially named for Arlington, but also for Garland. So, you know, you were in the thick of it.
Mm, deep cuts. Well, on today's episode, some of us will take a cold hard look at the marsh in Where the Crawdads Sing, something that I thought was a wild one-person show until I realized it was a very real movie. Then we'll tell you some of our favorite courtroom dramas. But first, it's time for IDIDIC, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? This is the movie news segment where we go over this week's movie news and answer the very important question, is this important and if we care? Alonzo, why don't you kick this off for us?
Oh, I would be happy to. Okay, this really should be an iffy story, but I'm going to read it, then you're going to explain it to me. There is now a Nintendo Pictures. Nintendo recently purchased a Japanese CG production company called Dynamo Pictures and has renamed the company, wait for it, Nintendo Pictures. Nintendo said the plan is to, quote, focus on development of visual content using Nintendo IP, unquote. No news yet on which IP they're thinking of utilizing first, though we already know there's that Chris Pratt Super Mario Brothers movie coming in 2023. Is this important? Do you care?
Yeah, this makes all the sense in the world. There's the properties that they already have. They should be, I mean, in charge of them, make your own stuff. They haven't had a lot of success. I mean, the last iteration of things before sort of Detective Pikachu, which I think was someone else's property that they optioned through them, was the like Bob Hoskins Super Mario Brothers 1,000 years ago, which, you got, correct me if I'm wrong, that's a perfect movie?
I wouldn't say it's a perfect movie.
A beloved by everyone, never been criticized movie. Am I getting that right?
That is one of my typical was it great or were you eight movies? Because there is no arguing with people who loved it as kids. Yeah, well, I'll tell you, you know, here's the thing, Gray. A friend of the show, Johnny Jungle Guts, did a list for me one time at the Wrap of he ranked the Pokemon animated films. And I thought there were five or six of them, and there's 20. You know, they just don't get released in the U.S. released in theaters.
So you didn't get them all.
He got them all. But it's bananas how much content there already is, and how they're certainly not sleeping on any of this. And Detective Pikachu, I'm sure, obviously they wouldn't have just handed that off to Warner Brothers without having some control of it themselves. But clearly they want every phase of the assembly line here, and why not?
I'm curious to see what they do. A lot. I looked up Dynamo Pictures, and it seems like they've done a lot of CG help on a lot of anime things. So to ringing in on Alonzo's take on the Pokemon movies, I think it's going to be the same thing where it's just going to be a lot of stuff Nintendo's going to do that only us weebs are going to care about. And the general public really might not even see anything that they have cranked out.
I feel like knowing that they do typically in the anime genre, and now they have access to Nintendo IP, really sets my sight on a Zelda movie. That's kind of the biggest thing that jumped out at me about this headline. I was like, that means, because they got Breath of the Wild 2 coming out, which is I'm really excited for, and I'm just hoping that maybe they use some of that Zelda steam to look at maybe doing an anime Legend of Zelda movie, which I would be incredibly excited for.
And
I care.
There's deep world building in that. Obviously, I've only mastered one video game in my entire very short lifespan, but it was a Nintendo property, so I'll be holding out for Duck Hunt whenever that comes to a cinema on my television, which is presumably where they'll release that. Yeah. Speaking of movies, sort of.
TM.
Speaking of movie makers, in fact, director Steven Spielberg shot Marcus Mumford's new music video with his cell phone, the very first music video Mr. Spielberg has ever directed. The Mumford from Mumford & Sons kicked off his solo career with a flourish as his music video for the new song Cannibal was shot and directed by none other than Steven Spielberg. In an Instagram post, Mumford revealed that the video was shot by Spielberg on a smartphone in a single shot. Better than that, I'll say that if you watch it, it's all one shot video, and there's a whole dolly panning thing. And Kate Capshaw, Spielberg's wife, was pushing Spielberg, an old man at this point, in a rolling office chair using his cell phone. And as someone who taught music video production at the university level for years, I've seen this technique before, and I was thrilled to see it here. Hey, guys, is this important? Do you care?
It's important in that I love that aging filmmakers still remain attached or can be flexible enough to become attached to technology as it changes. The great Agnes Varda had a whole late period of her career where she fully embraced digital cameras and loved how lightweight it was and how that she could just shoot as much as she wanted and all the different things that it really allowed her to do that film does not necessarily loan itself to, and made some of her greatest films, you know, like The Gleaners and I and Faces Places, you know, using newer technology. And this is in her 80s. So, if Spielberg, who is, you know, coming off of a, you know, tragically underloved adaptation of West Side Story, but that was a big bells and whistles, shoot the works kind of traditional movie, and can whip his phone out now and pull a Steven Soderbergh and, you know, do shoot something on it. I'm glad that he is not shunning stuff because it came around after he was already well established.
Yeah, that's truly, it's one of those things where it's you can adapt and fun, but also just kind of hearing it all said and done, it just feels like he was like, yeah, just push me around on this chair and let me just get the fuck out of here. Who is this, Mumford? Yeah, go ahead and just drag me around and I'll figure it out in post.
It does make sense to me that I agree with Alonso. I like the idea of him or anyone embracing new technology and playing with it. But I'm also grateful that he's like, okay, I'll do this music video, but like, I'm not going to make a Spielberg. Like anyone else would have been like, sure, I'm sure it's going to be a Mumford and Sons song or a whatever Mumford solo song. And then there's going to be like a young kid with big eyes and we're following them and they just got, like, don't make a Spielberg thing out of it.
He didn't hire Janusz Kaminski to come in, you know.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, I'll do it. We're doing it one take. My wife's pushing me in a chair, single location, Tuesday, 6 o'clock. I'm out. I rap at 7. Big fan of that energy.
Well, speaking of energy, here's a story about people who have too much of it. Fake accounts have been fueled the Snyder Cut online army in the hugest surprise of Max film history. Remember all those rabid Snyder fans flooding social media with demands to hashtag release the Snyder Cut? According to newly released reports, no less than 13% of those demands came from bots. This news was broken by Rolling Stone in an article that details the role that real non-bot Snyder army members and even Zack Snyder himself played in getting the Snyder Cut released by Warner Brothers. Is this important? Do you care?
It is important in that I hope that people learn from this and don't get fleeced next time. And by people, I also include the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, lest we forget that whole Flash Enters the Speed Force fiasco. As I've seen some people talk about on Twitter, like, you know, bots are one thing, but there's also the issue of puppet accounts. So in other words, like, you can start as many Twitter accounts as you want as long as you sort of occasionally check in and feed them. And somebody who, you know, gets a lot of hate on this subject on Twitter was saying, yeah, I checked this guy out and he started tweeting about the Snyder Cut, only ever tweeted about like Snyder stuff. The last time he ever tweeted was to vote for that Oscars thing, and that's it. And so, like, clearly this can't be this guy's only account. So, you know, if people with too much energy, if you have the time to keep 20 tabs open with 20 different Twitter accounts that you run open, you can just go in and like type in the same thing over and over again about like, yeah, release a Snyder Cut, blah blah blah, and boo on Amber Heard or whatever it is, you know, that you're trying to make happen.
Yeah, they're better hobbies to get. I agree. Like, to me, the lasting point in what you said there is, I hope that there's just enough residual shame from this kind of reveal to keep this sort of weird, aggressive, ooh, the fans are up. There's one thing when it feels like a genuine fan outcry. There's plenty of things that were like television shows that got canceled too early, or, you know, things that seemed earnest and lovely, and yes, let that story bear out. And there was something so ugly and aggressive about this one from the start. So certainly, I hope a lesson is learned in that. And I also, you made real small passing mention there to the Amber Heard of it, which to me, they're sort of tied together.
For sure.
As are, like, because the thing with that is it came out that freaking Ben Shapiro's website, the Daily Wire or whatever, had paid thousands of dollars to plant like anti-Amber Heard thing during the Johnny Depp trial, which started to really sway public opinion and stuff. Anyway, I'm now so reticent to believe anything as like a genuine groundswell of what the people are saying. I'm like, no, these aren't people. This is Skynet. What is happening?
Well, this is astroturfing, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also, I feel like it's just good that, you know, this was a whole HBO Max thing that, you know, the people who wanted it got what they needed out of it. Because I see in a world where theaters were still open, they re-released it and it bombed and they're licking their wounds of missing money. Warner Brothers Legal would definitely use this as a way to sue and make some of their money back. They'd be like, oh, we made that movie on false pretenses, you owe us money.
maybe Sony will use that defense for the Morbius reissue.
I was going to say I was getting some Morbius vibes. It was this whole thing was sounding very morbid time.
Morbius ain't bots. It is just a misinterpreted meme. Those are all real people faking enjoying this movie, and someone saw the bit that is the literal joke is your movie is so bad that it's a joke to like the movie, and they're like, these people like our movie.
They can't get enough of it.
We should definitely re-release it on way too many screens.
Oh my goodness. Well, on that note, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, where do the crawdads sing? Stick around and maybe you'll find out.
So you've probably heard about microdosing. If not, just know that all sorts of people are microdosing daily to feel healthier and perform better. Our show today is sponsored by Microdose Gummies. Microdose Gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good.
And not only does it do that, they taste wonderful. And, you know, it really does help you feel the right amount of good. Like sometimes you see some things that you wish you didn't, that you sat through and you had to chat through with your friends and it didn't quite hit the mark. And sometimes you're lucky to have avoided seeing it at all. In either of those cases, you might need to just chew a nice Lumi gummy and it'll get you nice and relaxed.
Microdose is available nationwide. To learn more about microdosing THC, go to microdose.com and use code MAXFILM to get free shipping and 30% off your first order. Links can be found in the show description, but again, that's microdose.com and the code is MAXFILM.
Maximum Film is supported in part by Masterclass. With Masterclass, you can learn from the world's best minds anytime, anywhere, and at your own pace.
These classes are legit. They have so many cool people who are teaching the classes, and they each have, like, they're in little bite-sized pieces. 10 to 15 minutes is what I've sort of discovered. So, for instance, are you a fan of Stranger Things, and have you thought about what goes into making a TV series? Well, the Duffer Brothers have an entire class about developing an original TV series. And then I won't lie to you, what has piqued my interest, although I've not yet explored it, you'll know once I do, because my world domination will take hold. You guys, Kris Jenner has a class that she teaches on the power of personal branding. And when Drea Clark is ready to just rise up and become her fullest Dreaist Clarkiest, it will be because I take Kris Jenner's The Power of Personal Branding class. I can't wait. I'm going to be unstoppable.
Check it out today. Get unlimited access to every masterclass. And as a Maximum Film listener, you get 15% off an annual membership. Go to masterclass.com/maxfilm. That's masterclass.com/MAXFILM for 15% off Masterclass.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm Drea Clark. Are you thinking, that doesn't sound like Iffy? You're correct. This is still Drea. Iffy skipped out on this movie for deep-seated personal reasons that may be revealed later. That guy. Anyway, I'm taking over while we discuss this motion picture. Iffy will return after the break. And still with me in the studio are...
Alonzo Duralde.
And Ellen Weatherford.
Okay, so not long after the novel Where the Crawdads Sing was published in 2018, it was a pick for Reese Witherspoon's book club. Nearly 4 years later, the book has been on the New York Times bestseller list for 169 weeks. I can't give you a frame of reference. That is so many weeks. Oh my gosh. It's been bought by like over 12 million people or something ridiculous. The film adaptation that we're discussing today, produced by Witherspoon and directed by Olivia Newman, is currently in theaters. And Alonzo, would you please give us a brief synopsis of Where the Crawdads Sing?
As some film critic said about something years ago, I didn't read the book, but boy, did I see the movie. Daisy Edgar Jones stars as Kaya. She is a woman who has spent her entire life living in the marsh in North Carolina, sort of apart from society. She comes from an abusive family and one by one is sort of abandoned by all of them, up to and including her alcoholic father. And so it's just her out there in the marsh on her own. She gets some help along the way from some local store owners, a black couple who sort of keep an eye out for her and help her out with stuff. But pretty much she's out there on her own and everybody in town whispers about the Marsh Girl. She becomes friends later on with a guy named Tate, who had been sort of a childhood friend, and they sort of grew up together and he was also living back there, and gets involved with a guy named Chase Andrews, who is local and too good looking to not be a total piece of shit. And ultimately, when Chase is found dead alongside a high sort of observatory platform for forest rangers out in the middle of the marsh, naturally the Marsh Girl is accused of the crime. A local lawyer comes to her assistance, and over the course of the film we get the flashback of her entire life story and everything that led up to that fateful night and the courtroom trial and the town turning on her and what will become of the Marsh Girl, and will she be cleared of this horrible, horrible murder? That is Where the Crawdads Sing.
I actually was one of the 12 million people that read this book, and then I also read every single article about Delia Owens and her own weird sneaky past, which we will discuss later, because obviously we're going to discuss that. But did either of you read this?
No.
Nope.
What? It's like you're not friends with a bunch of moms like I am.
I never heard of this book until the movie came out, literally.
169 weeks.
169 weeks on the bestseller list. It went completely under my radar. Did not even, I'd never heard of the title. Because that's a title you hear it once and it stays with you. I had never heard of this thing.
Yeah. Ellen?
I'm going to show my hand. I had never heard of the book or the movie until I saw all of the articles about Delia Owens. So that was my first exposure to it. I had already developed my feelings about her.
Marketing is marketing.
So, it was not a great tone to start this movie on.
And again, we'll get more into that later. Just putting that in like a teaser. Like, ooh, yeah, you guys, we can sound like a hot gossip site. So the thing with the book that's really interesting and is the number one misstep of this adaptation, but it's also tricky because on paper, there is plenty in this adaptation that I was like, they're ticking smart boxes. But in the book, the main thing is the triangle that's set up is Kaya, who's our lead Marsh Girl, and it's her constantly trying to navigate this triangle of nature and humanity. Whereas the movie, instead of, because those are like concepts, right? Like they're, oh, it's this whole thing. She's this girl who's like, little, kind of a Nell type, raising herself feral. In the woods, like partially feral, but also, participating in a capitalist system. So like she has all of these things going for her, and she keeps coming back to like nature will provide and the lessons we learn from nature and whatever. And then you see humanity as a counterpoint to that. And oftentimes every time she runs into a human, they're the worst. An argument I'm not going to fight for a lot of reasons because I've met humans, but in the book, it's so much more complex because you're thinking like, oh, what would it be like if you were growing up so separate from people and then just feeling the negative parts of them and not the positive parts of community or whatever. Whereas in this movie, I watched it and I was like, oh, this feels like a Nicholas Sparks movie, which I go out of my way to not watch. Was that a tone you were expecting?
I mean, definitely, like, it is this, like, these two hunks who are madly in love with me, and how shall I ever balance them? But, like, you know, the movie sets up the whole thing, like, she is this naturalist, and she, you know, writes all this sort of observational kind of, like, scientific thing about the life of the marsh, and she does these watercolors and these sketches of, you know, different, you know, flora and fauna. But it's like, at the same time, even though she is publishing books, and ostensibly you'd think the people in town would see and know that these books exist because it's about their area, they still treat her like she's the crazy lady who lives in a tree. And so I don't get how you have both of those things.
They also, the thing that just, it stood out to me more here certainly than in the book, this is this small southern town. And yes, she is a very eccentric character. She literally lives, like, there's a water pump. She doesn't get electricity till she's 20 or something. Sure. Very eccentric. And she's very poor and, you know, barefoot all the time. I'm like, I'm sorry, is this small southern town doesn't have any other eccentrics? Because I've been to small towns and they are normally chock full of weirdos. I mean, every town is. They just get a little more light shone on them in a small town. It's this whole, and the whole setup of it is this, we've all done wrong by this one single person. This one girl. And I was like, yes, fundamentally, again, you know who's treated worse by society? A very pretty, vulnerable white girl.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Also, yeah, the black couple who comes to her rescue, like, there's one moment in which, like, you see them being sort of treated shittily by some white person in power. And it's like, ah, yes, that's what they have in common. I'm like, do they? You know, like, are we really going to compare in the 60s the, you know, the white eccentric lady with the perfect teeth and, like, what these two are probably going through?
You mean Jumpin' and Miss Mabel?
Ugh.
That, I will say, that is the single line of dialogue that has subtext to it or has any, like, deeper element, because everything else is so on the nose. It's so, like, I'm just a girl in the world. Like, it's so just direct. And that is the one exchange when this, like, white developer or someone, he comes in and he says something to Jumpin', the black proprietor of this, like, small store, and says, like, oh, there isn't any reason you would be hiding anything from me, boy. And I'm like, oh, what? There's a layer to that question? Like, oh, you just racially insulted him, so yes, there is a reason. Literally the only yeah. line of dialogue I clocked in the whole movie that had layers to it.
The whole thing screamed romanticization of the mid-century South. I was like, this is an Instagram-ass version of the South. This is like...
Where's the polio?
This is what, like... Tumblr blogs think the South is like it's
Pinterest
just
barns.
Everything was so, like, saccharine and idealized and, like, just so the thing that really hit me about that was there's all of these scenes where they're, like, making out in the marsh. There's, like, these they're, like, luxuriously reclined
under the Spanish
in a coastal marsh. And I'm watching this. Okay, so I'm from Jacksonville, Florida, which is coastal salt marsh.
Recognize.
I've spent a lot of time in coastal salt marshes. You know what it's not? It's not sexy. It is. I tell you what that was like. Hot, sweaty, because it's extremely humid. It's salty, so everything smells like dead fish. And also there's mosquitoes about as long as your thumb everywhere. So I'm watching this and I'm like, recoiling in disgust. I'm like, you know that had to be uncomfortable. And I'm just like, oh no, don't. Well, you're gonna get so many UTIs. Stop. Yeah.
Well, speaking of the idealization of everything, the two guys in question are like such different store brands of cream cheese. Like, the guy playing Tate is like, I almost thought he was going to bust into Tomorrow Belongs to Me from Cabaret. So blonde and so kind of chiseled. And then you've got Harris Dickinson as the shit, who is like such an interesting and like layered and complicated actor. Like, if you see him in this movie Beach Rats, like, it's sexy but it's dangerous, but it's also like he's got a million different levels of sort of torment and kind of self-delusion going on. And here he walks on screen, you know exactly who he is and who he's gonna be for the rest of the movie.
You got Himbo and Jimbo over here.
Himbo and Jimbo, like I said at the start, on paper, there were decisions made. Like, I can't imagine the bidding war for this. It had to be astronomical. You end up with Reese Witherspoon And Hello Sunshine, her company, has turned into this like powerhouse, especially for women's stories. I say in sarcastic quotes. And the writer that they brought on for this co-wrote Beasts of the Southern Wild. Like, yeah, she already had something that had a similar tone, that had Oscar nominations, like the pedigree there. And then the director, and sorry, and her name was, the writer's name is Lucy Alibar. And then the director they brought in, it's her second film, Olivia Newman. And her first film is called First Match, which was a festival film. It premiered at South By like just a couple of years ago. And it was really interesting. She was working with really complex race and class issues. Like, they put together this team and had this property, and they attached, you know, the Daisy Edgar Jones, who's been this beautiful English actress who somehow keeps playing like underdogs. You know what I'm saying? It's one of those things, like, on paper, this should be knocking out of the park. But one, I got that sense of, oh, I could feel every note that had ever been given at any stage. Like, all of the dumbing down of the dialogue, all of the on the nose. I was like, oh, this is something that has gone through so many filters of the lowest common denominator. Like, right?
This is a good movie to see with someone with whom you can roll your eyes at each other in the dark. Because I saw it with Christy Lemire, and we would just turn to each other every so often, just wordlessly be like, because it is super on the nose. Like, the characters are all generally like one thing, you know, like your lead is like pretty and determined and smart and you know, like this naturalist, but like there's no humor in this film. It's deadeningly earnest, and it just, these characters don't come to life as characters. They're just these sort of like cardboard cutouts that serve the thing of the plot, and you see it all coming, and nothing is surprising, and it's just kind of dreary.
I felt like it was so strange that for a movie that is at its core, I felt like it was a romance. I really didn't give a shit about the courtroom aspect of it, because there was like no tension or urgency to those scenes at all. It felt very much just like those were just kind of there, like, obligatorily, I guess. But like, for a movie that was demanding to be this like story of romance and love, there was no chemistry at all between anybody. It was like it felt like the characters were supposed to be like falling deeply in love with each other, and there was just nothing really there. Maybe that's
where the realism came in, because they were too busy sweating and being bitten by bugs to actually generate that chemistry, you know?
I'm like, can you get some bug spray?
Can you just get
like some sunscreen?
I totally agree with you, Ellen. The idea of the courtroom as this framing device, like, it sets it up at the beginning. Like, we literally see this dead body in the marsh in the first couple of minutes. Like,
and then she's like in a holding cell to kick off the flashbacks.
With, like, the most adorable cardigan, like, dress. This girl,
she's cute as hell. Whole movie.
Her clothing, which is all secondhand, is all, I was like, okay, costume designer, I get it. You're like, here's the thing, this girl loves blue. She literally wore three shades of cornflower blue in every single, like, perfect fitting. And then she had, like, this one pristine white dress. Like, just, I was like, you're killing me. Also, please put your hair in a bun. Having your hair down when it's that hot, nightmare.
Yeah, the barefoot marsh girl, but she's so chic.
So chic. But the,
and she has her hair curled, like,
no, I, the hair
by the humidity, right?
Sure. But the whole thing of that cut, like, we kept going back to the courtroom, but like Ellen was saying, it lacked urgency, because it is, you know, you're getting this misdirect the whole time. Like, well, you know, the more they're laying out the case against her, the less it sounds like it's feasible. Am I supposed to care if she did this? Like,
well, yeah, and the movie's basically telling you, yeah, this murder makes no sense, and we're going to lay out all the reasons why it would be insanely impossible and complicated and convoluted to do it in this very way. And then it's like, oh, but she did.
But she did.
Infuriating. I was like screaming. I was like, what? Okay, the murder is by far the most important or most interesting thing that happens in the entire story. And it happens off screen and they never tell you about it.
And like, it's a very Agatha Christie structure of like what happened. Like, oh, she has to take a bus very visibly at what, and then an invisible bus later. Like, it's like,
I was screaming. I was like, show me that. Show me that happening.
Yeah. The most interesting thing.
It's the only interesting thing that happens in the whole story. And they're like, no, that's off screen.
Instead, we're
going to
watch her draw another shell. So, Delia
Owens.
Delia Owens. I told you guys, I was obsessed with this. So, the author of this story, she and her now ex-husband, Mark Owens, for years lived in Zambia. And the interesting parallels with this, so they are, he is wanted for questioning in a murder.
They're persons of interest.
They are persons of interest. And essentially, they like were so lockstep against poachers that they put together what sounds like just a real chill militia of their own.
Some casual vigilante justice.
Yeah, vigilante justice might have involved torture, but there was also like an ABC news crew that was filming them in the mid-90s that caught a murder on tape that the cameraman was like, yeah, Mark Owens did it. And the shape of it was very similar to the murder in this story. And I remember when this book was huge and I was like, no one wants to talk about this because this story came out and for some reason never got as big as you would think it was. Like,
it's Sharon Stone of Basic Instinct. You write a novel about the actual murder and then of course no one thinks you really did the murder because who would then write a book about it?
I was so worried no one would compare Where the Crawdads Sing to Basic Instinct and you found a way. No, it's truly insane. And it's also, it does tie in. It correlates with those themes of, you know, they were so, it sounds like their conviction of looking out for the animals that were being poached because, you know, like, oh, our connections to nature versus humanity, like all of those things tie through her real life story as much as this mystery does. Oh, if only the movie. If only the movie.
I'm only speaking about the movie because I haven't read the book. So I'm going to assume that the narrative of the book of the movie was the same as the narrative of the book. But and also my feelings towards Delia Owens and her narrative in the context of her life story, because I don't feel like you can separate the two, because it is clearly a commentary on her life story. So like you have, she forces you to draw those conclusions because it does feel like she's writing this story to justify the actual real life crime that she did. Like she's trying to do it as this sort of like, well, see, it was okay when Kaya did it, so if it's okay when Kaya did it because she's a sympathetic character, now you have to think it's okay when my husband did it because it was, you know, a survival, it was a self-defense, it was, you know, there was a line in the movie that I just about screamed when she said, sometimes for the prey to live, its predator must die. What?
Let me circle back to lack of subtext of like, oh, that's cool. There's no, that's exactly what you think. You just literally gave us your thesis and it's kind of an insane one.
Literally tell it to the judge. And of course, there's also the whole thing about how their website once referred to Africa as the quote unquote dark continent, which
there's weird dark stuff there too. Yeah.
The whole thing, the whole like vigilante, like murdering poachers, just like reeks of this horrible problem that is rampant in conservation and wildlife biology and everything, which is just like this white saviorism where people just think, oh, I, the white person, have to go into whether it's Africa or South America or Asia or somewhere. They think I need to go there and save them from themselves and save the wildlife from the people that have lived here for thousands of years, but clearly I, the white person, know better than they do. So I need to go in there and fix all their problems for them. And then they go in and think it's okay to just, you know, murder people, just like completely ignoring the like socioeconomic injustice that these people have been suffering through and like are largely trying to survive and support their families like any way they can. And they have millions and millions of dollars to support conservation issues, and they spend it on killing people rather than like investing in infrastructure or like supporting the actual people in any productive way whatsoever. Instead, they're like, we're actually going to buy a bunch of guns and run around in the woods and shoot anybody that we think looks like they're maybe in a place we don't want them to be. So just, it boils my blood how she tried to use this narrative of like oppression, right? Where like her character is this victim of oppression and she's been abused and, you know, all of the men in her life, like she's kind of like co-opting feminism to justify her racism. And it just just fires me up. Like, she's trying to get you to be sympathetic because she's using your, like, she's trying to use your disgust towards misogyny to prop up her own racism.
It's, I think we call that Karenism.
Once again, you put nature versus humanity, and I'm going to go with nature. So let us vote on this motion picture. I'm guessing it's going to be a big surprise to our listeners where we end up. But Ellen, on our show, what we do is you can vote to screen it, which is the very highest peak a film can attain. Stream it, which is, you know, streaming it. Or skip it, which is skipping it. So what would we vote? Alonzo, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. I'm a skip it, like skip it hard, skip to my loo, all the skips. This is embarrassing and it kind of shocking as like a, as you say, a movie with this many sort of talented people congregated to work on it and based on this novel that apparently a lot of people liked, which you can't judge because I haven't read it, but hoo boy, this movie is just what the British love to so colorfully call a dog's breakfast.
Ellen,
skip it. There's nothing of value here. There's nothing to be gained from watching this movie. It's boring, it's not fun to watch, and it's contextually awful. Watch Princess Mononoke instead.
Nice.
It has been a minute since we had just a trifecta of skip it, and here is one for you. And I will add again, I'm the one that originally put this film on our viewing board, so I feel a little responsibility. But that said, again, on paper, I really wanted something better from this. Alas, once again, humans have let me down. So there we go. We did it. And you know who didn't? Iffy. And we can remind him of that when he jumps back in, when we're coming right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
Hi, my name is Graham Clark, and I'm one half of the podcast Stop Podcasting Yourself, a show that we've recorded for many, many years. And at the moment, instead of being in person, we're recording remotely, and you wouldn't even notice. You don't even notice the lag.
That's right, Graham. And the great thing about this... Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Okay, and...
Okay, go ahead.
And you can listen to us every week on MaximumFun.org.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
Your podcasts.
Hi, it's me, Dave Hill, from before. Here to tell you about my brand new show on Maximum Fun, the Dave Hill Good Time Hour, which combines my old Maximum Fun show, Dave Hill's Podcasting Incident, with my old radio show, The Goddamn Dave Hill Show, into one new futuristic program from the future. If you like delightful conversation with incredible guests, technical difficulties, and actual phone calls from real-life listeners, you've just hit a street called easy. I'm also joined by my incredible co-host, the boy criminal Chris Gersbeck. Say hi, Chris.
Hey, Dave. It's really great.
That's enough, Chris. And New Jersey chicken rancher Dez. Say hi, Dez.
Hey, Dave.
The Dave Hill Good Time Hour. Brand new episodes every Friday on Maximum Fun.
Plus, the show's not even an hour. It's 90 minutes.
Take that, stupid rules.
We nailed it.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Wadiwe. Back once again. In the studio with me are...
Alonzo Duralde,
Ellen Weatherford,
Drea Clark.
First, Marissa has a Hall of Excellence update for us.
Yeah, it's me, Marissa Flaxbart. I'm also in the studio for the moment. And I am here with the long-awaited results of the latest Hall of Excellence. The category was Best Performance by a Supervillain. And you all were commended on your great slate of nominees. Commended in the episode by Stuart Wellington, who miraculously had exactly all three of the people that you named on his list and one more.
Which is crazy since he went last. So yes, he knew the exact ones we were saying. Yeah. Magic.
That phenomenon led Ray on Facebook to say, "Hey, this is a good ass list."
Well, oh, solid.
So,
I wanted you all to take that with you.
Thank you, Ray.
It's a victory all around. But of course, the ultimate victor, surprising no one, is Michael B. Jordan's Killmonger from Black Panther, the first one listed and the nominee that led everyone in the room to say, I was going to say that.
I know. I feel like we should have called it at that moment. The moment we were all like, that's our pick. And it's like, well, meeting adjourned.
I know. Yeah.
Hey, look, this is my first W for this. Don't take it away from me.
You did it, guys.
Back in the pre-producer Marissa days, you guys would have had it already decided among you. But we know for sure that the people also agree. 50% was how much of the vote Killmonger got. Second on the Facebook poll was Catwoman, and then Doc Ock, and then Wenwu. So exactly the order that you guys named them in is the order
Sounds about right.
All right. So thanks to everybody who voted on Facebook. Yay. And remember that you can join the Maximum Film Facebook group if you're on Facebook and vote for things like this and make comments and talk. It's facebook.com/groups/maximumfilm. And with that, I leave you.
Thanks, Marissa.
Bye, Marissa.
Thanks, Marissa.
It's time for me to take you all to court. Murder Trial is the narrative thread that holds this movie together. So in honor of that fact, let's get into it. What's your favorite example of a courtroom movie? Who plays the hero lawyer in question? Let me know.
I'm going to go old school on this one. And my vote would be Billy Wilder's adaptation of Agatha Christie's Witness for the Prosecution, which is, I'm sure lawyers will tell you why it's nonsense, but it is rich with like surprise witnesses and the whole courtroom going, you know, that kind of thing. A delicious, delicious performance from Charles Laughton as the lawyer who is called in to represent Tyrone Power as an American living in London. Who's been accused of murder and insists that he is innocent. Over the course of the film, we get to know Power's wife, played by the magnificent Marlena Dietrich, giving a role that is just full of surprises. Elsa Lanchester as the nurse who is making Charles Laughton's life hell. They were married in real life. It's delicious and just like fun and hammy and dramatic. And, like all Agatha Christie adaptations, you can't change the ending. So if you've ever seen any production of Witness for the Prosecution, you know who did it. But nonetheless, this really is more about the journey than the destination. And it's my favorite.
That's such a good call, Alonso. And it is, like, I know even at the time, I mean, Marlena Dietrich in this is so good, and it's a little different from what people saw her in. And funny for this entire category, I have a natural, I don't like watching shows with courtroom scenes. Like, I don't watch TV shows that have courtroom stuff, largely, especially if it's sort of modern day contemporary setting. Because, I am so enraged and frustrated by our legal system in so many ways that even in fiction, I am like, what? Oh, God, great. Let that guy out. Cool. Like, I get too upset. And it's maybe comes from the same place. You guys know I also can't watch any movies with gambling in them. I'm really sounding like a Puritan here. So I will say I do have movies that have courtroom elements that I love. And my all-time favorite, To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, Gregory Peck is Atticus Finch. One of my cats is named Peck. And one of my previous batch of cats was named Scout. So, I mean, like, I'm kind of always covered this. Yes, from 1962. It's the whole thing of it. It's combustible, but he also has this fantastic monologue at the end that I can't even imagine. They probably don't anymore, but I can't imagine how many people have auditioned for things with that, because it's just a sort of barnstormer of...
Well, you know, it's a Broadway show now. In fact, it's coming to L.A., so like that monologue lives, believe me.
What's next? You're going to make American Psycho a musical? I mean...
Who would ever? That is a great one. And it's also where, if you didn't already know the word chiffarobe, you will learn the word chiffarobe.
Ellen, courtroom dramas.
I feel a little out of place because I'm bringing something new.
Bring it.
Ooh.
2020. It is the trial of the Chicago 7.
Ooh.
It's on Netflix. And it's just a gorgeous movie, I think. It was had like just a sort of stellar cast. Like there were like no misses in the cast, I felt like. And especially I felt like Sacha Baron Cohen was incredible. I mean, he's, you know, going to bring the absolute most to anything, but he was really good and delivered just like a really powerful speech at the end. And it was, I really enjoyed that movie. It also hit at an incredibly poignant time. Because so much of the film was like about how protesters were abused by the, not just like the police, but then also the legal system and like it zoomed out and just looked at sort of, it like shone a spotlight on all like the glaring failures of the legal system from like the top down. And that hit in October of 2020, which is like, just a gut punch of timing for that movie to come out. And then I also felt like that was a courtroom movie where the defendants were the star of the show. A lot of times I feel like the lawyers are the star of the show. And this one felt like the defendants were the stars and they were kind of their own heroes. They were sort of saving themselves. And I don't know, it's heavy. It's a rough movie. I know there are a lot of moments of humor in it. Like, it's surprisingly funny. There's a lot of moments that are just legitimately, like, laugh out loud funny when you don't really expect them. But then there's also moments that are just, like, heartbreakingly horrible to watch. And I'm glad that, Drea, you mentioned that you don't, like, you get easily stressed out by these things, because I'm very sensitive. I'm a sensitive watcher of everything in general. So I do have a tendency to, like, get very easily like, I'm not having fun watching this, you know, but it's I don't know, it's also validating, and so I really like that movie.
And the connection is Aaron Sorkin wrote that movie, and he also wrote the new stage production of To Kill a Mockingbird. So,
oh my god, and the music for American Psycho the musical. Just kidding, that was Duncan Sheik.
And mine is the easiest layup that I thought I wouldn't get to pick, but then I was like, oh, I feel like it's so easy that
I feel like no one's going to pick it.
Yeah, it's 12 Angry Men.
Boom.
Yeah. To me, it resonated because it was like, you know, I saw it a long time ago. You know, every school makes a kid sit through this, but then you watch it. But also just like the idea that, you know, someone standing up for, you know, someone wrongfully accused in hopes of getting that person free. You know, the first time we believe that we have a fair justice system in this country. But yeah, so 12 Angry Men, my pick, take you all the way back to 1957.
You guys know how I feel about men, so I didn't want to play that one. That was not
Yeah. I was looking up to see if anyone did like
there's like 11 too many of them in it.
You know? A like revamped one, but there's a play called 12 Angry Women that was published in 1955.
Well, Amy Schumer did that. The Inside Amy Schumer.
Right.
I thought was pretty clever and well done.
And there was a more recent 12 Angry Men that was done for like Showtime or something. In 97 with like Jack Lemmon and George C. Scott that I heard is good too.
Can I give an honorable mention to old Aaron Brockovich and Julia Roberts' performance in it, which I always enjoy because it also gave you investigative elements and not just courtroom.
It took everything in me not to say Legally Blonde.
Legally Blonde.
I love Legally Blonde so much.
Yeah, I don't know what kind of pod you think we are.
It's such a good movie. And
you do not wash your hair after you've gotten a permit.
As anyone would know, chutney. Yes.
Oh, right. Well, you know what time it is. It's time for staff picks. It could be any movie at all. So go ahead and fire away.
Oh, I'll start. So this is a movie that I super loved in the 80s. And then for quite a while was not around. It was this weird, it was that period of Columbia Pictures where David Putnam was running the show, and so he like hired cool like Euro art house people to make movies that no one saw and that the next regime of Columbia barely released. One of those movies I'm picking today because it is also an adaptation of a novel about a woman who is an outsider and is a film that I'm a huge fan of, and that would be 1987's Housekeeping. Directed by Bill Forsyth, based on the novel by Marilyn Robinson. Christine Lotti gives an extraordinary performance as a woman who is suddenly having to take care of her teenage nieces, the older of whom kind of, you know, clicks with her on a, you know, we're weirdos, but it's the 50s and weirdo is the only way to go level. But the younger one very much kind of goes hard in the like, no, I want to be little miss, you know, conformist, pretty 1950s ideal kind of gal. And, you know, more and more like the outer world threatens to sort of tear this family apart. It's beautifully done and really subtle and shot gorgeously. Like it has a real sort of like a Pacific Northwest cloud cover action going, shot by Michael Coulter. But yeah, Christine Lotti, this is like, I think one of the greatest things she ever did. And it's a movie that not nearly enough people have seen. And guess what? It's on Tubi.
Oh, what?
Yeah.
Housekeeping.
Tubi gang.
My film is something that was touched on in our earlier discussion, but it is indeed Beach Rats from 2017, starring Harris Dickinson, who played the dead and the alive Chase Andrews in Crawdads. And yeah, Eliza Hittman did this. It was her film before Never Rarely, Sometimes Always. And it is wonderfully sexy and introspective and complicated. It takes place in Brooklyn and follows this guy as his parents encourage him to get a girlfriend. And then he also spent some time cruising a gay beach. So lots to dig in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Beach Rats.
Ellen, do you have a pick?
I do. It is related to today's movie in many ways. It is an adaptation of a novel. It does center around women and like female protagonists and also people dying. And
Valley of the Dolls. No.
And it takes place in a southeastern coastal swamp. It is Annihilation.
Ooh, that's a nice fun pick. Bridge you built. A fun
very
bridge.
Out of character for me to recommend a horror movie. I don't typically, like I said, I'm a sensitive baby, and I don't usually watch scary things. And Annihilation we saw because we did not know it was a horror movie. And so we went to see, we thought it was just like a sci-fi girl power adventure like sort of thing, and we went to see it in the middle of the night, and then had to walk home in the dark afterwards. Ooh. Which was horrifying, but it's a really good movie. It's a, you know, this cast of women like scientists who have to go rescue their husbands, so it's a complete reversal of the damsel in distress trope. They're also all scientists and like biologists, so they're going through this region that has been affected by something called the Shimmer, which is like a mysterious phenomenon that's causing all sorts of bizarre things to happen in this swamp. It's horrifying. Like, there are some things in the movie that are just like viscerally disturbing that like we think about sometimes. Like, we'll just be like, you remember that thing from Annihilation? And I'll be like, yeah, I don't want to though.
I think Crawdads might have benefited from that thing.
Yeah, Annihilation. And I also just feel like I got what I wanted from Annihilation, which was like there was so much like the land and the nature and like the very unique scenery played a very active role in the story, which was what I wanted from Where the Crawdads Sing. But like it felt like the swamp was a character in the story of Annihilation, and I really liked it. And the author, Jeff Vandermeer, the author of the novel, wrote that novel based on the swamps of Tallahassee, Florida.
which is in the Panhandle. So up near, you know, the like Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana area, it's kind of that sort of ecosystem. And you can, it just really feels like a love letter to the Florida swamps. So I it's unusual for me to love a horror movie, but that's my pick.
Solid.
Nice.
Iffy,
what you got?
I did a little bit of threading myself by simply looking at the cast list, which is, I notice one Garrett Dillahunt is in this film, which is in another film I referenced last week that came out in 2007. He was in No Country for Old Men. Go ahead and watch that. Go ahead and watch that. See my boy Josh Brolin, pre-Thanos. You know, pre-Thanos, Josh
Brolin. That's how he thinks of his career. I'm sure.
But yeah. Oh, yeah. He's like, life before Thanos. What was I even doing? Was I even truly an actor? Milk? What?
Iffy, do you mind if I spread the rumor that you refuse to see Where the Crawdads Sing because there's a black man named Jumpin'?
Oh, you can definitely say that.
You can definitely as say you that. Should. Yeah. That is grounds for boycott.
If his last name isn't Jack Flash, then why did you even write that movie?
Excellent.
Yeah, but go ahead and peep. No last name listed.
And the Boneyard.
So that could be our headcanon, is that is indeed Jumpin' Jack Flash. Oh my god.
The Crawdad cinematic universe is really expansive. Yeah. Oh, deep lore.
Well, look, thank you so much, Ellen, for coming on, blessing us with your knowledge and your opinions. Where should people seek you out?
Thank you so much. I'm on Twitter. It's just my handle is Elk's Needle, but if you look up Ellen Weatherford, you'll find me. But I am the host of Just the Zoo of Us, which is a podcast on Maximum Fun. It's all about animals. If you're an animal nerd, you would probably like it. It's also family friendly. I don't swear on that show. So if you got, if you're the kind of person who's listening on a commute with kids in the car, it's good for popping on then. So I stream video games on Twitch sometimes, which is really fun too. So I would love for folks to come hang out with me online.
Do you curse on the Twitch?
On the Twitch. It's all family friendly.
Rarely, but not never.
I just sometimes. Yeah, always. Yeah.
It is. It starts at 9, so I'm hoping that means there's no kids watching because they should all be in bed.
Good. Well, I have friends who have family friendly streams, and whenever I stream a game with them, you know,
it becomes a different kind of family.
They immediately, and I always apologize. Because I'm like, I have one mode when I'm gaming. It's dirty mode.
No, that definitely pops in sometimes. And so I won't say 100% of the time.
Well, Dre and Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show and for holding down the middle part of the episode for me while I took a little break skis.
You're welcome.
Yes, you know, and look, you listener. Thank you. And if you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at @maximum_film. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/maximumfilm or send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. Our producer is super and it's Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producer, also great, Laura Swisher. This is a production of Maximum Fun. Bye-bye.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.